Okay, look at your questions in the back of lesson 13. We are talking Wednesday about really some of the English development of the English church, various English Protestant churches, as the beginning of what we would ultimately start studying and actually moved into to some extent regarding the various doctrines and groups that are in the States now, or and then from there even into the world. And began with the Episcopal Church, the development of that. And all I want to do is just talk a little bit, go back to the question number one. It's one of those open-ended questions about the doctrines and practices that we talked about last lesson. How would you address some of those? What are, you know, just name one, and how would you address it from the standpoint of the Bible? It's going to be a little bit. This may be a little bit like the one we had on Tulip. Maybe I should ask the question first. Who all has worked on this? Uh-oh. Lesson 13. What page is it? 108. Page 108. You will notice that just because it doesn't have lines on it doesn't mean it's not a question page. I know that was tricky. 108. Well, I think I'm getting the answer to my other question. We'll hit it. We're going through this anyway as a way of review. Okay, the organization of the Episcopal Church is the Episcopal government, supposedly. But the way they use that, who makes, what's the ultimate authority in that organization?
Well, they would say it's a creed.
They've got a creed, and they base it on what's called the 39 Articles. There is a organization, though, that I mean, are the congregations autonomous? First of all, do you remember what they even call it? I didn't cover this specifically. What do they call a congregation? It's just a Catholic term.
Yes.
Parish.
Yes.
And what do they call a group of parishes?
Yes.
Dioceses. Okay. And do they have... I'm going to get there. Yeah, we're going to work out. We'll just run through it real quick. And how do they determine the officers of the local church?
The bishops
go around and ordain? No. They elect them. They appoint them. Who do they appoint, though? From the church, from the congregation, from the parish.
Priests and deacons.
You know, if you...
Huh? Does the bishop following on going around do the pastor?
No, hang on a minute, we'll get there. Keep guessing, we'll get the answer. Priest. Okay, so everybody in this room who's a Christian in a Episcopal church, I mean, you're a Christian, what are you? I mean, in God's church, if you're a Christian, what are you? You're a saint, what else? You're a priest, we're priests. But if you're in an Episcopal church, you know, priest is an office, it's not the Christians. And you're elected to that.
One priest per
diocese. One priest per congregation. And then they will go a step further, and that diocese, we're going to get to these guys, the diocese appoints who?
Bishops.
The bishops. Okay. And then the bishops, and then there's the body of bishops, body of I don't remember what they call it exactly, but the laity. And they end up having this general convention. So we get to the answer of where's the legislative body? It's the convention that they hold every 3 years. And out of that, they elect what?
Presiding bishop.
And this is the one that's made headlines. Well, two of them made headlines, really, that we talked about, just from a contemporary standpoint. But the head bishop right now, the presiding bishop, is a woman, and that's created problems within the Episcopal Church. Okay, they have doctrines. Their doctrines are, obviously, their creeds. They have a creed, and it's already been said, or maybe it wasn't said, no such thing as creeds in the Bible, so you won't find authority for that. within their creed, basically what do they adhere to? What's the Episcopal Church adhere to in the way of creed? There's seats up here. Basically. Sorry? Yeah, okay, but I'm looking for a little more. Do they believe in...
the Church of England.
Yeah, I mean, they follow basically the same creeds of the Church of England, but it's a... in fact, they do follow it before the Adel is breaking up. But it's a... do they believe in total depravity?
Yes.
Yeah. Do they believe in baptism of infants?
Yes.
Yes. And they believe in... Their Protestantism, if you please, ends up largely being one of organization. They broke away. From the history of the Church of England, they broke away from the Church of England. The Catholic Church, on the basis of the organization. The King took it over. So it's a the Church of England is ruled by a magistrate, if you like. Okay, well, that's. Just by way of review, we have an Anglican Church, Church of England, and we're going to move down that path. The Episcopal Church was one development out of that, and we've got some others. We'll move down that path. One thing I'd suggest to you is in the back of your class lesson, there is a chart. It's called The Development of English Protestantism. And I take that out. You might want to take that out and just hold it in front of you. At least I have to, because I, by the fact I'm the teacher and I've studied this stuff, keeping all the players straight gets to be a bit of a challenge. Because a lot of it sounds like, it may sound like to you some of the same stuff, but it because there are groups that are splintering at this point in time. Okay. The Congregationalist, the development of that comes about like the development of a number of these as it moves to the States. It come out of the controversies that were going on in England, and we're going to see coming out of that something we're familiar with in U.S. history, and that is the Puritans, the Pilgrims, but we're focusing initially on the English side of this. Remember at one point in time, when a couple of lessons ago, we were dealing with the separation of the Church of England, and what came on the heels of that with the various queens, and we ended up, at least among the queens, Queen Elizabeth was in power during one of these phases, and basically she was trying to bring back, and did successfully, have Protestantism and tried to appease the Catholics, but ultimately she had to break away from that. So Protestantism, the Church of England, maintained its structure. But during this period of time, there was another group that was kind of a thorn in their side, I suppose, and that was the Puritans. And the Puritans developed initially with the idea, and you can get it from their nickname even, the Puritans, groups that were within the Church of England that wanted to purify the Church of England. And they wanted to purify it in a number of ways. Primarily, they started out dealing with the liturgy and the ceremony, the things that were carried over from the Catholic Church. And this is what they opposed, things like use of Saints' Day, clerical absolution, sign of the cross, custom of having godparents in baptism, kneeling for communion, and the use of all the gowns and that kind of thing, the supplice that the various officiators wore. And so they were against this, and they also, evidently there was some, at this point in time, and you can understand this when you think about the leader being the king and the queens and the kind of lives they lived, the Puritans observed, or disliked, deplored the loose observance that existed at the time in the various aspects of Sunday and the service. They started to follow the initial groups following the fellow named Ames, or at least his teachings. and I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I want to talk about the other side of it, what kind of produced him as a leader. We hit on this briefly back a few lessons ago, a fellow named Jacob Arminius, and he was in Holland, and this is where we get the so-called Arminian doctrines. I want to talk. I'll hand out a sheet to you in a little bit about Arminian versus Calvinism and let you see this. But this Ames fellow was in Holland at the time and was very active in opposing this Arminian theology, and he was opposing it because he was a strong Calvinist. So these groups that are going to be involved in this Congregationalist development, by and large, their theology is going to be Calvinistic. They continued to grow. They actually had influence in the University of Cambridge, England, we know about. Had a number of teachers there, and had, as far as members of their group, they would have lawyers, merchants, and it was a group that tended to have a mix, not the least of which were some of the educated of the time, the prosperous of the time. Elizabeth, I mentioned, once she kind of unburdened herself from the problems of the Pope, she turned on the Puritans, and she started putting laws in place that would gave her the right, in essence, to persecute the Puritans. And, of course, again, they were just trying to get purity in the Anglican Church at the time. As that was going on, out of that came a couple of different groups, people really that led groups. One was Thomas Cartwright. You'll see him showing up, coming off of looking at your little chart. Cartwright sort of shifted the emphasis from reform of the liturgy to broaden it and move on to reform of the theology and the organization, the church organization. He did not believe the Bible taught governorship or government by bishops. And remember, bishops here, when we talk about bishops now, we're primarily talking about this individual or individual that is different than what you and I would think about as bishops, and that is elders. These were superior to the elders. He, on the other hand, thought that the organization of the church ought to be under the control of a presbytery. You know the word. Of what he called elders and bishops. So he still made the distinction between the two. What he was saying, you shouldn't have one over the other. They ought to be combined, and they ought to run, they ought to organize and be in control, and primarily have spiritual function. Separate yourself from the church, from the state. Yeah, Mike.
Did they have more local autonomy? The presbyters had the presbyterians.
Yes. They wanted more local autonomy. I mean, they weren't here. They didn't have it yet. That's where he was pushing to.
They wouldn't have this priest as episcopals had over the local congregation. They'd have had this group of...
They would move differently than that.
Elders and presbyters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the Congregationalists will come out of this, and that's direct...
But he gets away from...
They want to get closer to that. That's the intent. That's where his mind was at the time. Move away from one-man rule. And then on up to the point where that one-man rule ultimately ended in the King of England, King or Queen of England. The theology, as I said, was basically Calvinistic. The government was by, he proposed government by, in a way his groups would break off, government by the elders who were elected out of the church and appointed by the congregation. So he sort of laid the basis. Now he'll go on. What will develop out of his line, as you see there, is the English Presbyterian Church, and that'll be the legacy that he had. And in fact, the modern English Presbyterian. And look, these terms, you've already seen Episcopal, Baptist, Presbyterian. We're getting to the point where now you get into. It's not like the Catholic Church, where it tended to be a development that coalesced and stayed more or less constant. Things would break off from it, but it maintained the Catholic Church today, as we've seen, has a history to it. And no matter where you are in the world, they kind of trace their history back at least to a certain point. When you start talking about a Presbyterian, it's going to depend on whether you're in England or you're in the U.S. today. They're different. Just as an aside, you go to Australia. I ran into this. You'll drive down the street and see churches, a number of them that say, church sign out front says Church of Christ. There's no relationship to what you think of in the United States as the Church of Christ with those Churches of Christ over there. It's an entirely different group of believer of beliefs, totally unassociated with what we think of. And so anyway, that's somewhat true in these various denominations we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about. So beyond Cartwright, there was another fellow by the name of Jacob, and he would be considered, and we're going to talk about two different groups, independents or separatists. He would be considered the founder of the independent Puritans that would develop and turn into a Congregationalist over time. They weren't so much interested in separation, and we'll talk about Robert Brown in a bit, like he was, but more they were wanting to bring about change, certainly within the Church of England. And at the same time, that change was inconsistent with the Church of England, so they did not, even though they did not separate, they still got persecuted. And we'll kind of talk about where they end up in a moment. Jacob, when James I came on the throne, James I is the James who was in office when the King James Bible was brought about. He was actually King of Scotland and became King of England. And because of his history, the Puritans thought they could make hay with him. And so they put together what's called the Millenary Petition. And the reason for that is it had 1,000 different demands in it, or requests, whichever you care to call it. But he was not received very well, and he ended up being imprisoned because he had the view each congregation should be left free of the state. So he's telling the King of England, you shouldn't have authority over the church, over congregations, period. And that got him in jail, and he got out and migrated off to Holland, and then he would ultimately go back to England worked for a group of independents in London, in the London area. And so your independent or congregational Puritanism in England, this is where it started, got its roots, and it would grow from there. He didn't, you start to talk about what came downstream, and we won't talk about Jacob any longer about that because he had some of the, he planted all the seeds, but he didn't carry through in the sense of there was no lineage, if you like, developed out of his teachings directly. No, I'm on Jacob. I'm sorry, the other Jacob, Henry Jacob. Henry Jacob. Yeah, sorry.
His thinking was right.
Oh, yeah.
It was just very unpopular.
Yeah, and it has an impact. We'll see the same thing with Brown. Brown has an impact, but Brown doesn't. The differentiator here in terms of history is these people, their teachings have influence, and what'll happen is some of the people they influence will then go off and be active in other ways, and we'll see that in some of this. And those other ways will lead to a development of some sort of a belief system. Whether it be a Congregationalist, General Baptist, in case of Cartwright, it would lead to English Presbyterian Church. Henry Jacobs, while he had an influence because of his teaching, the influence will show up in the form of other people deciding, either in a parallel or because of his influence directly somehow, starting other groups. The followers of Jacob Jacob did have some followers that came out of England and ended up being independents, off on another guy, namely Brown. The followers, if you look on your chart, end up being down the road and have something called the Savoy Declaration, and it'll be an attempt, at least, on the part of these independent guys and the separatist guys to come to grips with the difference between the two. And it's actually just a Calvin. They formulated a creed, what it amounts to, that represented what they believe. And so you have what comes out of that is either eventually what will come out of it is the English Congregationalists, not the American, but the English Congregationalists. And that's the end of their story, and we'll leave them there. So you've got Congregationalists that have been established in England in the mid-1600s by the influence of Henry Jacob. Oh yeah, still Calvinistic, and like I say, we won't talk about them anymore because we're not. We're ultimately trying to get to and stay in America.
At this point, it seems like all the issues have been over authority and control and such. You know, among these groups we talked about so far, Calvinism has not been the issue.
No, only among the Anabaptists.
Yeah,
and there are Armenian theologies that are developing. I mean, the guys we've studied so far, other than the Anabaptists, it's been they've stuck with the theology. It's been organization primarily. Okay, let's get into section two, and a fellow named Brown, and Brown really started. There's a fine distinction here in this Congregationalist area. We're going to see something develop along with Congregationalists that has to do with what's called a covenant. They would make a covenant, and that would be a distinguishing characteristic about them. And the covenant is among the members. Okay? Brown himself established a Congregational church based on that principle in Norwich, I guess they say in England, and while he was there, he wrote a treatise, and it was called A Treatise of Reformation Without Tearing for Annie, and I'm sure Annie means something, I'm not sure what it is, but he set out views on the relation of the church and the state, and he insisting the authority was not with the magistrate, it was more this organization thing, it was not with the king, or king's appointees, as a case, but it was really and it shouldn't have authority, and the authority should be within the from Christ, the Bible, and the organization from within the people that are in the group. And he would propose that these people covenant together to form a local work. And so Brown was the guy that set the basis for, the organizational basis for what would become the structure of these separatist Congregationalists. And really, in America, for the independent types, it was the idea that a group of people who had the Bible could covenant together to form a work, an organization, a local work, self-governing, autonomous, and will not have interference from the state. It is the separation, if you please, of state and religion, state and church, by covenanting together. And so we'll see that belief system carry on with the Congregationalists even to this day. I've listed some of the principles. The first one I just talked about. The second one, similar, that it was... You know, they believed that Christ was the head, not the king or any other man. That each church was self-governing. Now, they chose a pastor. You know, they didn't make a distinction between pastor and elder, you'll see on the page. But they chose their leaders. and said this is what the New Testament designates, which, you know, I would take exception to, but this is what they teach, and that they were autonomous. And, you know, like all these groups, there are variations over time. His idea would lead to, his teaching, these teachings would lead to these separation groups that would come about. I've shown on your chart, the chart I told you about, one called in 1587. There was actually one before that. So the three of them that I wanted to talk about, the first one I'm not going to say much about other than tell you it existed, a fellow named Fitz in 1567 had a group of separatists that developed separatist type of congregationalists, and that group eventually died. And then you had the influence of Brown on these three fellows, John Greenwood, Henry Barrow, and Francis Johnson. And they ended up going off to, they first showed up in England under the Greenwood and Barrow there. And those two guys got hung. Like I said, they were people being persecuted this time. They got hung for what they were teaching. And so Johnson took over that group, and they went off to Holland. And they, again, there's a, evidently there was a development of the term called ancient church that was associated with that group, but it did not have any significant successors. There was a third group then that went off. These were out of Gainsborough, Scroby or Scrooby, whichever way you pronounce it, Scrooby, I guess, which are two towns not very far from one another in England. But they were, you know, kind of like a couple of groups meeting. And they ended up coming off again off of this lineage that traced its way back to the Anglican Church, wanting to separate from them. They had these this fellow that I've named where he is, John Robinson, that was instrumental originally in leading the Gainsborough group. I'm sorry, the Scrooby group, and they ended up in Leyden, Holland. There's a fellow that was associated with him, William Bradford, and I'm not a history buff like some, but Bradford was governor of Plymouth at one time after their first year anyway, when most of them died, half of them died. So he came over to the U.S. and we'll mention him in that context. But he came out of this group that moved from Scrooby and set up in Leyden, and these were separatists among the Anglican split-offs. And they were separatists who had congregationalist views, okay, in terms of how they organized. And the other group out of that general area of Gainsborough, Scrooby, was led by a fellow named John Smith. And ended up, they got set up and started to interact with the Mennonites that were in existence. And Smith really got himself associated with the Mennonites, and there was some interaction with the Mennonites, and ultimately there would be a part of the congregation became Mennonites, and a fellow named of Thomas Helwes, I guess, didn't take to that with time and separates out and returns back to England, and they organized, he and his followers organized what would become the English Baptist group. Okay? So that's where that line goes to. Following, and when we get into lesson 14, well, some of this we'll touch on a little bit more because of the U.S. side of it. The Scrooby group ends up being going off as, I think, I don't know what it shows there, it doesn't show there directly. They ended up going off part of their group ended up going off to set up a separatist colony in America. And this will be the where the separatist Congregationalists end up landing at Plymouth. And so when you read about the Pilgrims, what we call the Pilgrims today, that's where that group came from. And they were escaping the persecution that was going on in Europe. But these are the kind of beliefs they harbor. And in fact, the Mayflower Compact, yeah, this is secular history, from your history, which most of us probably don't remember, but this group, before they went ashore, or maybe before they left, formed a compact, a social compact, a governmental compact for when they landed. And that was that same principle, just like they were applying it to the religious organization, that covenant together. And so it applied, you know, went right over in debt to that life. Well, as you well know, they had a lot of trouble the first year. It was hard and lost about half the group. And this is where Bradford stepped up as governor in the following years, and they soon prospered. There was another group then that shows up that founded Boston and the Massachusetts Bay Company, or part of that. These were non-separatists. You know, start pulling your fingers up. You got separatists, Congregationalists, Pilgrims, Plymouth. You got this other group, which actually is much larger. It becomes the Settlers of Boston, and under the what would be called, or be, what was the, I guess the economic organization, the Massachusetts Bay Company and their colony. And they were better financed, there were a lot more of them, so they developed as well in the area, and they were the non-separatist types. And so for a long time, in fact, when we talked about the English, the American Revolution, you know, at this point, they still and would hold the not allegiance to the king so much as allegiance to the Church of England's doctrines, and associated themselves with that. So, it, you know, even though they came from two different lineages, if you like, one being one that wanted to separate from the Church of England, the other one that wanted to just improve on it, they all went to this, went on this principle of congregational autonomy through covenant. And so you have these Congregationalist churches that were prolific in the colonies during this time and would develop to be prolific in the colonies. And so you had the Church of England and this group. These were the primary groups, I guess, in U.S. history as far as the time of the Revolution. Well, they took on what was the king, largely what was the Church of England theology. It was Calvinistic at this point. And it would change, but that's what it was. And it had influence. Others had influence on it, but that's where it started. And in fact, there was a synod in 1646 the four Puritan colonies in the States, what would become the States, adopted the Westminster Confession. And we haven't covered the Westminster Confession. We will, but just, you know, make that note. They did that, and declared each church to be autonomous. So they're working together. They're there claiming their autonomy, but then they went on to say they would work together, and so they have some sort of a loose organization that they would work together with, those four colony church groups.
You may have covered this, and I was asleep or something. It may be something obvious, and I'm still asleep. You got concerning the principles, you know, stated by Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Each church is self-governed. I mean, such a, yeah, each church is self-governed. Choose a pastor, teacher, elders, deacons, and widows.
Oh, I didn't follow up on that. I think what that means is, yeah, they identify as a widow indeed. Put the widows on the list. I think that's what that means. Yeah. So they didn't declare you had been, your husband had died. It was relative to how they took them under the wing. Okay.
It's just interesting that comes out in the organization.
Yeah. And it probably has some degree, probably has some connection too. I'm going to guess some connection the way it was handled with the Church of England, in terms of their, how they handle it with us. But I don't know that for a fact. There is a period that we're going to hear this term applied if we ever get to it. In the days of Alexander Campbell down the road and Barton Stone, people like that from U.S. history, something called the Great Awakening. Only in this one, there are actually three for sure, maybe four great awakenings that people talk about. This is the first one. And you start to see the inconsistency, if you like, if you stand firm to Calvinistic theology, the inconsistency of that starting to develop in this. In the States with these kinds of groups. The Great Awakening was 1730, 1750 was the first one, in what's called the Great Awakening. And in the course of that, there's a fellow named John Edwards, who was a Congregationalist, and he started being very active in evangelism. Each of the, from the standpoint of the States, they had churches here. Every town had a church, basically. So you had these various communities developing as time went on. They all had their own little church, and of course they had their own pastor and elders and did their own thing in these areas. But as time goes on, there were some of those, even though they were strict Calvinists, there were some started to espouse a little different theology, and they started preaching. And this fellow by the name of Jonathan Edwards was one of them in the 1700s. And as a result of that, they ended up preaching, and the theology started to open itself up to be somewhat independent. I just use the word somewhat independent from Calvinistic theology. They were starting to think more liberally around that theology during this period of time. And it also, and I guess it was just the general idea of freedom was the other piece of it. And so they were starting to, in the colonies, for a variety of reasons, independence and freedom of mind, thought, action, that kind of thing, made this period of time right for this great awakening. Didn't cover it, but like I say, about 20, 30 years, and it would eventually die down as far as a movement, but it left a mark on the people, and they were turning more to liberal, from their standpoint, liberal theologies. And so that just is a sort of a backdrop for what would happen down the road.
Well, let's see if I got this right. Of course, you don't have the page number, but it's under the origin and growth of Congregationalism, and it's paragraph C and D, where the church and Congregational Church in England, someone was hanged there, for denying the Queen and her supremacy. And then they went to Holland, and then from Holland, a group of that came to America.
Mm-hmm.
And this group was opposed to government control of the mm-hmm. religious affairs. So this same group then comes to Plymouth. Now it says here there were different, right, non-separate.
which item are you reading? Is it C? C, second paragraph?
Yes. That group that came to U.S. and C, that's a different group than the ones in D.
Oops, where'd my D go?
The ones
in wait a minute, sorry. Yes, yes.
It's a different group.
Yes, two different groups.
But they're both congregationalists.
Yes.
They're both congregationalists.
Yes.
It's different.
One's independent, one's separatist. That's why I say go back to the chart. I know how to keep them straight. Yeah, the independents, we call it independents. They didn't want to separate. Now, in fact, they did. I mean, this is a question of mind versus actions. They didn't want to separate themselves from the liturgy, basically, of the liturgy and creeds of the Anglican Church. They wanted to improve on it, but they didn't want to pull away from the church. And look, it's not terribly unlike what went on with Luther in the Reformation. He did not want to pull out of the Catholic Church originally, but that's what happened. That's what had to happen because of his views. He wanted to reform it. That's why we get the name. Same thing here. The independents wanted to reform the Church of England. The separatists said, no, we didn't want anything to do with it. We're going to pull out. We need to separate ourselves from it. Massachusetts colony with the independents. Okay. Plymouth Rock bunch, separatists.
So then the non
all congregationalists.
The Puritans, the Puritans then wanted to come over and mimic what they had as far as government control, what they had in England, by setting up this Commonwealth and have their own state control, just like England had its own control. Is that
I don't think they wanted to do that, Mike. I think it's more of a case of they did not want to. They wanted to have influence on the Church of England to make a change, and they were not given a hearing for that, and to perhaps to be able to practice it. And yet still associated with the Church of England, they left England and came to America, even still calling themselves just non-separatists. I can't defend them. I'm just saying that's what they did.
Well, the reason I'm asking is they came and established a government, the idea was to establish a church that was established by the state. And just like in 1592, when someone denied the Queen's supremacy, they were hanged, and they came and they did the same thing. So it looks to me like they're really mimicking what they had in England.
In fact, that's where they want to end up, but that's just not where. I don't think that's where their thinking came from originally. It was just to keep the king, keep the connection, and they had to. They were driven out. I mean, I understand what I'm saying. It may very well be that. I know on a road, it may very well be that's where they were. That's what came into their head. But in fact, they just didn't want to. They did not want to cause the King of England. I mean, Church of England to disappear. They wanted the whole Church of England to do its, to modify itself, kind of thing, and let them operate with some autonomy. And it wasn't happening. And yeah, when it came to the states, what's going to happen is they get their autonomy, but they're missing something, and that may have led them. Once they see what they're missing, then it may have been back to the let's set up the godly commonwealth, if you like, that's described there. Sorry to make that confusing. It's just I can't get in these people's heads on all these things. I don't know. Because it doesn't make, a lot of this doesn't make, it's not rational, as we've seen.
It's a different Reformation and Restoration.
Yeah, by what we know. Okay. Man. We'll close out with the modern congregationalist and move on to the modern congregational church and move on into what would develop into the Baptist, English Baptist. Lesson 14, if you didn't get it, is up here.